This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When people get to define the problem frame, like what it is, the problem that they're trying to solve, then they go looking for technologies that solve that problem. If what you're looking for is something that just makes more power as cheaply as possible with no, you know, thought about the environmental repercussions, social repercussions of any of those things, then that's the solution that you find.
In the first half of the 21st century, discussions about the future of energy abound. Engineers are in hot pursuit of new technologies that will provide green, inexpensive energy. But how new are they really? Today's guest on Sea Change Radio is Alexis Madrigal, whose new book, Powering the Dream, unearths a number of green technologies that emerged in the 19th and 20th centuries. Despite their promise, these early attempts to use solar water heating, electric cars, and wind power fell flat. In the next half hour on Sea Change Radio, find out about these innovations and learn why Alexis Madrigal remains optimistic despite America's history of false starts. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's also a visiting scholar at Cal Berkeley's Office of History of Science and Technology. His new book is titled Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Alexis, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Your book documents what you call, quote, our country's previous attempts to secure a more perfect power in hopes that future ones will succeed. It's really a great glimpse into ideas for energy solutions that were ahead of their time. Or were they really ahead of their time at all?
Well, I actually don't think of many technologies as being sort of necessarily ahead of their time. I think they were trying to solve a different set of problems than the one we're trying to solve now. So I think, you know, when you look at, say, solar hot water heating at the beginning of the 20th century, where, you know, if you'd walk down the street in Pasadena, California in 1905, you would have seen solar hot water panels all over the houses. It's not necessarily that it couldn't have worked. It didn't work. I mean, in fact, it did work. And it's not even that it was ahead of its time in the sense that people already wanted solar, they already wanted hot water, and there was the sun. It was just that people at that moment were not really considering the environmental impact of burning fossil fuels in order to get the heat for hot water. So one of the big bonuses of the solar hot water is that you're not burning the natural gas, and you know, if that doesn't really matter, if you think that it's actually good to burn fossil fuels, as much of the United States did for much of the 20th century, then it doesn't really matter why, you know, it's just a purely economic trade-off if there's no benefit or to solar or downside to fossil fuels.
Did you have any epiphanies while you were putting this together and saying, you know, a lot of these things really could have happened if X, Y, or Z hadn't stopped them from happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably two big things to look at there, just that it's really difficult for a lot of solar technologies to compete, just given how the market system that we choose to believe in works in this particular case, which is that over the short term, a lot of solar technologies look quite expensive. Over the long term, they don't. And, I kind of would think it's more like like sort of going to get a bunch of groceries versus, you know, going to grab fast food, right? It might look more expensive on the one-day timeline to go to the grocery store and spend $200, like sort of getting food that you can cook over the next couple weeks versus like spending $5 on a hamburger at McDonald's. But, you know, over the time period that you're going to be using those foods, like it ends up being cheaper almost always to go to the grocery store, no matter how cheap the prepared food you're getting is. And I think it's kind of a similar thing, right? With solar, a lot of the time, you don't pay for the fuel, which is going to be the cost over time. You're just paying for all of the upfront stuff. And it makes fossil fuel-based technologies look sort of artificially cheap on a longer time period. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. I think the other big thing to keep in mind too is just, you know, how sort of historically embedded our like notions about what it is that we should be doing with energy really are. You know, up through, you know, say after World War II and up into the 1970s, I mean, the stated goal and policy of utilities was this, what they called grow and build. Like the whole point was to have more power, not less. And it was really only in the late 1970s that that started to change even a little bit.
And that's, is that what you're referring to when you said where technology is really, you're looking at whether they're raising us or lowering us? Are they just giving us an incentive to waste?
Yeah, in this case, I mean, the way the utilities worked, and, you know, I mean, I think even now, if you look at the statistics in the energy department, you'll find that people, you'll find that people still call it electricity sales, right? And so what do you want to do with sales in pretty much every company? You want to, you know, make more sales, not less sales. And that's, I mean, I think that's really the larger overall point, right, is that when people get to define the problem frame, like what it is, the problem that they're trying to solve, then they go looking for technologies that solve that problem. If what you're looking for is something that just makes more power as cheaply as possible with no, you know, thought about the environmental repercussions, social repercussions of any of those things, then that's the solution that you find. And I think that's the key takeaway from the book.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and his new book is called Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Alexis, can you give us some examples from the book of alternative energy innovations that never made the type of mainstream impact that one would expect?
One of the best stories is about the electric vehicle company. This was a place that inaugurated taxi cab service in Manhattan with electric cabs. So in 1900, you could have taken, you know, an electric cab down Broadway. The company actually combined the financiers who'd built trolleys in Philadelphia and New York with a bicycle company of Colonel Albert Pope, who is a leading bicycle manufacturer and so therefore the leading individual transport manufacturer in the country. With an electric storage battery company all built around two engineers' design of an electric vehicle called the Electrobat. And they actually, they sort of fell prey to a pretty classic startup move. They overexpanded, tried to open up offices in a bunch of different cities, trying to get scale. So they opened up in Chicago, various places in New England. They had sales agents in Mexico City and Paris. And they really wanted to build this alternative transportation, well, what would have been to us now, an alternative transportation system based on electricity, not on fossil fuels, where you would use trolleys and these electric runabouts. And the reason that seemed attractive to people, I think, is that at that moment, many people had gotten wealthy on electricity, on electrifying the transport system. And I think it's just, it's a fascinating thing that when the rich people of the day looked around at like where profit centers could be in transportation, they went to electric cars and trolleys, not to the gasoline-powered vehicles that ended up dominating our transportation system. And another sort of fascinating thing to note here is that it kind of made sense. Like if you were thinking about it, there were only a few hundred miles of paved roads outside of America's cities. So actually a huge group of bicyclists called the League of American Wheelmen were responsible for the Good Roads Movement, which aimed to get stuff paved and laid a lot of the groundwork for touring, as it was called, being able to, you know, drive outside cities. Because really, if you tried to take, you know, any car outside of America's cities, you would have had a really difficult time driving it on the roads of the day. And so it's a way of thinking about what types of systems end up supporting any individual technology, right? It's not just the internal combustion engine that allows gasoline-powered cars to beat out electric alternatives. It's also that the utilities didn't support the electric vehicle industry. It's also that bicyclists were pushing for better roads. And it's also that there was a kind of just pure fun in the speed of the gasoline-powered cars. It's described by a naval historian named Tom McCarthy in a book called Automania. It was fun to go fast, and in the early days, it was easier to make a gasoline-powered car go faster. And so the electric vehicle company did collapse. It's known, one historian, automotive historian, called it the monopoly that failed. This was a time when, all kinds of industries were coming under monopolistic control. And I just think it's a great story for a lot of reasons, even though it ended differently, not least because it conceptualized transportation as a service, not as something where you bought a 2,000-pound machine and then drove it around. And I think that's perhaps part of that vision that we'd like to recover, where you don't have to own a car in the city. You can use Zipcar and subways and ride shares and all the other things that are now becoming available in modern cities.
Please tell me why. Every woman I know is crazy by automobile. Every woman I know is crazy by automobile. And here I am standing with nothing but rubber heels. Hey, every woman I know is crazy by an automobile.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. My guest is Alexis Madrigal. He's the author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Tell us a little bit about early compressed air technology, which is making a bit of a renaissance on a small scale these days.
Yeah, so I think people are interested in it now because we know that we can pump air into underground caverns, the kind of things that actually store now fossil fuels. And we could get when you compress air, essentially imagine the air is like a big coil, like a big spring, because that's really what it is. You're pushing the molecules closer together than they are sort of in the atmosphere. And then what happens when you, provide an escape for them is they come rushing out at like basically the speed of sound. And so because of that, there's a lot of power in the molecules. And that's what that's how a compressed air system works. And we now are thinking about doing this for wind power, right? Because if you think about the problem, or one of the problems with generating electricity, is that you have to use it at that moment. It's like the strangest commodity. It's like, the second a car came off the line, you had to sell it that second. And it makes for a really strange market. And it means that you can't store it except in batteries and other really expensive ways. And so this is considered a way that could work for inconstant power sources like wind or solar. But specifically wind is how most people are thinking about it. And in the old days, there's actually a lot of research on this topic, and there's a lot of thinking about this topic because in the 1880s and 1890s, people were not sure how we were going to transmit power, right? Like, if you think about things at that moment, it's like a little bit like the tattoo on my arm. Like, everything had to be touching another thing, right? So if you wanted to move a crank, it needed to be attached to some other mechanical thing. So steam engines were, like, let's take, they're at the Centennial in Philadelphia in 1876. There was this huge steam engine in the center of the room. And every single machine, and there were thousands of them, were drawing all the power from that same machine's movement. So it's pumping up and down, and there are all these levers and cranks and pulleys and gears in order to drive every other machine from the same motion of this steam engine going up and down. Now, we don't really think about things like this because we can just plug into an outlet, right? Like, if you wanted to like run your computer, if you need the amount of power to like run your computer, right? And you had to have like some wheel cranking right next to it, right, to like turn everything. I mean, that's just, it's like totally preposterous. And so people thought about using compressed air as this way of transmitting power for long distances so that you didn't have to have every single, you know, machine hooked up by a crank, lever, or pulley to a steam engine. And so underneath the city of Paris, they actually built this huge system to both run the clock, so they would send out little bursts of air every minute, move the clock hands of Paris forward 1 minute, what they called the pneumatic distribution of time. And they also started running all kinds of machines and other things. And of course, for renewable energy, this is interesting just because you can store the air, as discussed. And so you can imagine some sort of you know, counterfactual history where compressed air becomes really good as a technology, and as a result, it's easier to incorporate renewable energy into our power system.
Alexis, talk about some of the early solar and wind developments that were ahead of their time.
In 1941, the first megawatt wind turbine was completed in Rutland, Vermont, by a team that included FDR science advisor and a bunch of heavy hitters from the big universities of the country, the big engineering university of the country, MIT, Caltech, Harvard, et cetera. And it was 10 times bigger than anything that had ever been built before. And there was only one machine in Russia, actually, that was even one-tenth of the size. It was completed, actually, amazingly, with basically no government support, and ended up failing a few years later, kind of sadly, but becomes a really good example of how to fail well, which is another theme from the book, in the sense that, you know, this that particular project was ahead of its time.
What was the name of the project?
Well, they called the Smith-Putnam wind machine or wind turbine, and the Smith-Putnam is just a fascinating project. I mean, there is a book called Power from the Wind by Palmer Putnam, who designed the operation, and Smith comes from they were actually a hydroelectric turbine company that got involved in the manufacture of the thing. But I mean, you have to imagine at this time, we actually had almost basically no idea of how the wind actually worked. You know, we almost think of it as like, you know, when like a character runs in a cartoon and there are like three straight lines behind them. That's like how people actually conceptualize the wind scientifically. But really, we know that like wind is much more three-dimensional than that. And it blows up, it blows down. And so they were trying to design this entire wind machine that was, you know, this unprecedented project with like less computing power than you would have, you know, on your iPhone. I mean, it's like they had a really, really tough task to try and design something that would work and wouldn't break. And in fact, it did work. It worked a lot better than actually some later wind machines designed by, 1980s inventors. So it's really kind of an amazing thing. And though the project itself failed, they made the amazing decision to actually put all the information that they had gotten into the public domain. So they wrote this book. They put all their data out there. They told everyone what happened and where the failure points were. And in fact, later researchers in the 1970s and beyond sort of say that Palmer Putnam, the guy who designed this machine, is essentially responsible for the U.S. having any kind of large-scale wind turbine research done.
And on the flip side, we have solar. Today we have the NREL, but its antecedent was the Solar Energy Institute. Can you talk about how that helped create an infrastructure and brought us to where we are in terms of solar?
You know, one of the problems from, say, about, you know, 1940 to 1975, and actually really more like 1995 or beyond, in energy research, in particular in solar energy research, was that most of the country's energy infrastructure and R&D infrastructure was centered around nuclear power. And this is just kind of a historical accident. You know, the Department of Energy grew out of, you know, its core is the Atomic Energy Commission, which dealt a lot with, you know, the promotion of nuclear power.
This was during the Cold War, so there was a more obvious national security element to the citizenry who was paying for this, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, the other thing is we wanted to be able to offer civilian nuclear power to the countries that cooperated with us because the Russians were saying that they could offer that, right? So they're it was something that seemed to fall within the purview of geopolitics as much as it did R&D, and so the Atomic Energy Commission becomes this dual role agency of both regulator and promoter. But if you look at the structure of the Department of Energy, I mean, a big chunk of it is managing our nuclear weapons, a big chunk of it is doing nuclear power research, and then this tiny part of it, or relatively small part of it, is dedicated to like all the other types of energy research that you might possibly want to do. And this situation, that's even now, this situation was much worse in the 1970s when solar energy was really looked down upon at basically the nation's national laboratories, which is where the DOE's work really gets done. A place called the Solar Energy Research Institute was created by Jimmy Carter to become a home for solar technologies. He made a guy named Rappaport, who'd worked on solar cells at RCA, the head of the institute. And it was supposed to be just a place that could really do the sorts of research and really advocacy that the atomic power guys had for a long time. Unfortunately, like, it immediately becomes kind of a political football, right? I mean, as soon as Reagan takes office, he essentially guts the thing because he didn't believe in solar power.
It was weak and wimpy.
Yeah, it was weak and wimpy, and like, it was soft. It had this like smell of the counterculture on it, and so they just wiped it out. In fact, the first Department of Energy head that he appointed was a dentist from the South who had been a longtime nuclear energy promoter
and hated hippies.
And of course, the head of the Solar Energy Research Institute was a guy named Dennis Hayes, who had been a longtime solar proponent and who now runs the Bullitt Foundation, and who, in fact, you know, was like a jeans-wearing, long-haired hippie guy. Actually, we grew up in adjacent hometowns, but he's, he's definitely the kind of guy that Reagan's dentist Department of Energy head would hate, you know. So, and in fact, they did. I mean, they went down in flames, and in fact, they had been promised a new building in the 1970s, and that new building was just completed a year ago.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Alexis Madrigal. He's the author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. What were some of the more head-scratching inventions you encountered in your research?
Well, I think, you know, my favorites, in fact, I like them so much that I actually got one of them tattooed on my right arm when I finished this book. I was really a fan of the wave motors of the 1890s and aughts, the first decade of the 20th century. In California, there were all of these people who were, San Francisco, L.A., San Diego, who were, you know, stuck away from where there's a lot of power, and energy markets were really regional then, right? There's no national grid. At that point, natural gas fields that powered a lot of California's early history hadn't been discovered. And so they're forced to import sort of expensive coal and burn it for various reasons. And so all these people who are starved for power and are paying too much are like, walk out into the ocean, get hit by a wave, and are like, look at all this power out in this sort of infinite expanse of water. And so they started designing all these wave motors. So in both in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, there are dozens of teams working to design wave motors. And, you know, they're everyone from Mulholland, who ended up, you know, building the water system for Los Angeles, to, you know, crazy guys like Terrence Duffy, who was sort of like a florist and a total nut job, actually. So there are all of these different guys, right, are attracted to this idea. And in fact, in 1895, I think it was the San Francisco Call or the San Francisco Examiner, one of the big San Francisco papers at the time, put out a call for like the idea that would help San Francisco continue to grow. I think they said maybe to get to 1 million residents or 500,000 residents, something like that. And there was a panel of judges who selected the from the ideas that were submitted by their readers, including a future mayor of San Francisco. And the idea they selected was a workable wave motor. Like that was considered to be something that would have been just a boon for the city of San Francisco, given the waves there. You know, the problem was that none of the wave motors really ended up working. Sometimes they would work for a while. Sometimes they would you know, a lot of the time they would try and sell them by having like a little bathtub sized model. And I think, you know, the problem is that, you know, it seems so easy. The motion of the waves are going to, you know, move some crank and something else is going to happen. Something else is going to happen. And then all of a sudden you'll have electricity on the other side. But it turns out that translation is quite difficult. It's kind of the perfect Rube Goldbergian idea about how easy wave power is going to be and how difficult it actually is. It's just, you know, one thing touches the other, and next thing you know, you're lighting a light bulb. But it turns out that in reality, transforming the motion of the waves into electricity is incredibly hard.
So, Alexis, what other early inventions do you think could still be viable today? And when you were researching this, shouted out at you as, you know, these really are worth re-exploring.
I think, you know, if we want to talk about old technologies, though, that might come back, or just the trolleys. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but really, like, every major city, like, if you go through one of those, like, Chuck Berry songs where he, like, calls out various, like, industrial towns of America, mm-hmm. That, like, every one of those cities would have had a trolley system in it. And, you know, the commute time, I did some, like, little calculations when I was working on a talk in Los Angeles, that the commute times in from like the east side of LA into downtown would have been like comparable on the trolley in like 1920 to what it is now. So like when we talk about, you know, things getting better, it's like not really, you know. And if you had that trolley system, right, you could still be using it. And unfortunately, there was, you know, direct competition for what the road was, like what roads were supposed to be. And if people had been able to hold together when they were mad about people driving on roads, when roads had previously been used for all kinds of stuff, you might have actually seen cars not do well. In fact, you know, Woodrow Wilson, 1907, was giving a talk where he said, nothing has increased socialistic sentiment more than the automobile. And it's because there were all these rich guys' sons driving their cars and, like, killing poor people. There was a new section appeared in the obituaries called Death by Wheel. And, you know, you just had all these people dying as a result of the beginnings of the car transportation system.
That's interesting. So it kind of magnified the widening economic gap of the time, which is similar to now. But for the 100 years in between Wilson's time and today, we really we've thought of the automobile as one of the great levelers of society.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, what's interesting now, I mean, if we want to take that social lesson, I mean, the people who are really getting screwed the worst right now are people who are really dependent on your cars. And, you know, if you're way out in the exurbs, I mean, like, that's where I grew up. I grew up in the exurbs of Portland, Oregon, in southern Washington state. And, you know, I drove 40, 50 miles a day growing up. And I think, you know, that those are the people who are most vulnerable to climate shocks and energy shocks.
Alexis Madrigal, the author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Alexis, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Have a great day.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Rye Cooter, the Derek Trucks Band, and Lou Reed. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For SeaChange Radio, I'm Alex Wise.